Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What is the future of Scott Air Force Base? As the Pentagon faces budget cuts, how will those cuts impact military and civilian personnel at Scott? It's the region's largest employer and pumps some $3 billion a year into the local economy. So cuts in jobs or income will likely hurt the region economically. And of course, Scott and its personnel play a significant role in national and international security, not to mention significant humanitarian assistance in times of emergency around the world. We'll be talking about Scott's importance to the world and the region and try to get a handle on its future. Illinois Democratic Congressman Bill Enyard is with us for a few minutes by phone from Washington. His 12th district includes Scott. With me in studio is Lieutenant General Robert Allardyce, Vice Commander of Scott's Air Mobility Command. And a little bit later, we'll be talking with Jeff Michalki, a civilian employee at Scott, also with the Air Mobility Command. Congressman and General, so nice to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Don.
It's great to be with you, Don.
Congressman, let me start with you. Our time together is limited, but it was disclosed very recently that July 8th is the date when things begin to happen. That's when civilian furloughs will begin to take effect. The commissary over at Scott's going to be closed once a day. There are going to be some fitness club fees, as I understand it. What do you see as the near-term future for Scott?
Well, I think the near-term future for Scott is certainly bright. I don't see any immediate impacts to Scott, no closure, no BRAC closure, that sort of thing. But I think that having said that, though, we need to work to ensure that Scott remains the vital presence that it is. And really, of course, in the district, in the St. Louis metro area, and throughout the region, we're concerned about Scott as an economic engine for the area, but also because it's such a vital part of our nation's defense and the great work that's done at Transcom and AMC and the 126th there refueling wing of the Illinois Guard and all those other great units is absolutely critical to our nation's defense. So we need to, and I'm working with the Southwestern Illinois Leadership Council and I can tell you that everybody's on board with protecting and preserving and enhancing Scott, whether it's labor, industry, management, political figures. I've, in fact, flying out to Washington, D.C. yesterday with Ann Wagner, we were talking about the importance of Scott. So, it's across the river, it's across the aisle, and it's a unified effort to ensure that Scott remains a strong, vital presence that it is.
You mentioned BRAC, and I just want to make sure that members of our, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later, but I want to make sure that members of our audience realize that that is the process by which Congress may or may not close some military facilities in various parts of the country. Getting back to your statement about the bright future, and we certainly hope that that is the case. However, as these furloughs begin and as some cuts are developed, that is likely to have some impact on our local economy, is it not?
Right. And when I talk about the bright future, Don, what I'm talking about is on the macro level, on the big scale. I think Scott is certainly secure for the next few years, but the sequester cuts are having an impact on the workers at Scott, on the civilian workforce, and on the Air Force Reserve technicians and on the Illinois Guard technicians. We've had some success in rolling back the initial sequester. It started out at a full month of work. It started out at 20 days, and we've got it down to 11 now. But that's still not where we need to be with this. The importance of Scott, I can tell you, I was standing on the flight line at Scott Air Force Base when the call came in that we needed refuelers to support the effort in Libya. And they were ready, and they rolled off the line, and they were there. And they were there because of the great work that's done by the guard technicians, the reserve technicians, by the civilian employees. The military folks rotate in and out, but the civilian employees, the DOD civilian employees, are the corporate memory of the military, and they stay there. I just wrote a note to a lady who's retiring at Scott after 50 years of service. It's hard to replace that kind of service, that kind of memory, that kind of institutional memory. So we have to. We can't be penny wise and pound foolish here.
Do we have any sense as to what the dollars and cents economic impact of what we know is going to happen actually is?
You know, I would defer to General Allardyce on that. I don't have that number at my fingertips. You're talking about in terms of the sequestration, Scott?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have that number in my fingertips.
Let's bring the general into the conversation. Do you have a number, General?
Yeah, thanks, Don. Well, for the civilians alone, if you look at it, there's about 5,100 roughly civilians employed in all the organizations at Scott Air Force Base. So that's military civilian employees. And what the 11-day furlough translates into about $14 million in payroll that the country will save, but that won't be available for those people and the local economy. So $14 million just in the payroll. And then there's other cuts that are associated with the sequester.
Such as?
For example, the consumables on base, our operations and maintenance budgets are restricted. And so less money for fuel, less money for grounds care, less money for the typical things it takes to run an installation.
How will these furloughs work? I mean, is it going to be a day at a time structured over a period of weeks or months?
The Department of Defense has essentially indicated that there are some exceptions to furloughs. So there are a few people, Child Development Center, for example, Office of Special Investigation, the kind of the critical agencies, very, very few, less than 50, would not be furloughed. For the people that are furloughed, essentially, it turns out to be about one day per week because it's 11 days till the end of the year, but there'd be only about 11 weeks left. So it's one day per week. Every agency handles it a little bit differently.
Congressman, I'll put this question to you and then to the general. I know you spent some time recently at Scott. What about the morale factor? Have you been able to pick up anything with regard to deterioration of morale as a result of this?
Well, I think there's clearly an adverse impact on morale, Don. You know, you're looking at folks taking a 20% pay cut. These are my friends and my neighbors, you know, folks who live right down the street from me. We work at Scott Air Force Base and worked there for many years. And that's having a dramatic impact. You know, I met with the local car dealers. They're concerned about this impact. If somebody's taking a 20% pay cut, they're not going to buy that new automobile. They'll be holding back on back-to-school spending. You know, they're not going to be buying as many clothes or shoes or backpacks for the kids going back. So, you know, we're talking about $13 million cut, but it's a 20% pay cut because of the brevity of this and because of the fact that Congress didn't get a budget adopted and we're still acting under a continuing resolution. So, you know, for those families, that's a profound impact, and that's going to ripple through our economy because that salesman at the car dealership isn't going to get a commission because he didn't sell a car to that worker at Scott. And I'm concerned, too, about the impact on readiness on those Air National Guard tankers. If you're not having those Air National Guard technicians, and for that matter, on the 932nd Air Reserve Wing, if you're not having the Air Reserve technicians, because they're considered civilian employees, although they're in the Guard and the Reserve, if you're not having them out there maintaining those planes, what impact is that going to have on our readiness? So it's not only an impact on the local economy, not only an impact on our civilian workforce, but it's also an impact on the readiness. So that all can certainly add up to some morale problems that, frankly, I don't think we need.
It certainly resonates particularly with you, given your past role as the chief of the National Guard in the state of Illinois.
Well, it certainly does, Don. And,
yeah. Yeah.
As I mentioned before, when I was on the flight line at Scott when they launched for Libya, and that was in my previous role. Not as a congressman.
It's a quick question to you, General, with regard to morale, but then I want to get to mission. The congressman alluded to it. Is the mission of what's going on at Scott going to be affected by all of this?
First off, let's address morale. You know, the congressman talked about this lady that he wrote a letter for, served for 50 years. Mm-hmm. These people are great patriots, first and foremost. Our civilian employees give so much more than you might think, 40 hours a week. They give of their life and their blood and soul. So it's hard for all of us to work through the process of us walking up to them and saying, you can't work more than 32 hours a week. Some of them, frankly, are perplexed with that. and I've seen a lot of posts and discussions that associated with that, that they're really struggling. And not just at Scott Air Force Base. This is something that our Department of Defense civilians are just struggling with. And so the uncertainty is another thing. Is it going to, you know, they're grateful that it's not 22 days or 15 days as it slid down. Now it's at 11 days. But the uncertainty alone has really grated on them. So we'll work through this together because they're great patriots. And then I can address the readiness if you'd like me to.
Yeah, I'd like you to. I think that's probably sure. The most important part of this.
You know, the congressman talked about how the 126 was able to immediately react to the Libyan crisis. Now, at that same time, as you remember, this is a couple of years now, we had operations going on in Afghanistan. We had increased operations in the Mideast. The Japanese triple black swan event, when we had the earthquake followed by a tsunami followed by the nuclear meltdown, was going on. And at the same time, we had operations, frankly, down in South America and operations in Libya. The entire mobility system that we run at Scott Air Force Base is command and controlled out of the tanker airlift control center there, all flexed to meet each one of those demands instantaneously. And we called our guard brothers and sisters, the 126, said, can you respond tonight? And they responded instantly. They were trained. They were ready to go. When you cut back on the readiness training, the ability to respond that fast begins to decrement. So we aren't there today. We don't know exactly where we'll be there, but we are clearly on a glide path that begins to jeopardize our readiness.
That was going to be my next question. Could you pull that off today?
Today, frankly, we believe we could today. It will take time because we are reducing our training. We're trying to be very careful and make sure that people need it, the most training get at the proper time. But across the Air Force, you know, we've grounded squadrons, flying squadrons, means they don't get to fly. And we have absolutely decremented in the mobility world, the tankers and the airlifters. We've cut back on the training. So 6 months, that could be a problem.
Congressman, a lot of people, since the sequester went into effect, have said, you know, everybody was making these dire predictions about how awful things were going to be once it did go into effect, and that it doesn't really seem to be that bad. Your thoughts about people who have been thinking that way, and is this thing creeping up on us to the point where it is going to be that bad?
Well, you know, Don, we have been working very hard to try and fix the problems with sequester, and we've been able to mitigate some of those problems. You may recall that all of the air traffic control towers in southern Illinois were going to be closed because of the sequestration, and we were able to get that extended. And you know, the flight tower for the Southern Illinois University Flying School was going to be closed, and we were going to have student pilots up there without air traffic controllers. And we've been able in the Department of Defense to mitigate it from 20 days down to 15 and now down to 11. So by working smart instead of working dumb, we're able to fix some of these things. But we need to get a budget adopted so that we're not at a continuing resolution, so that the impacts of the sequestration get magnified.
Why can't that happen? This will be my final question. I know you have to go, but why can't that happen? I think the general feeling amongst the American public is that the ladies and gentlemen who reside or preside on Capitol Hill are more interested in getting reelected than they are in dealing with these problems. These are major problems. They're hurting a lot of people. Why can't the folks get their act together?
Well, you know, Don, that would be a graduate level course in political science.
That you're there, Congressman.
I am. And it would take far more time to run through that. But essentially, you have some people sitting in the halls of Congress whose default answer is no. That's on one side of the spectrum. On the other side of the spectrum, you have people whose default answer is always yes. And so, unfortunately, those folks are sitting in districts where they win by 65-70% because of gerrymandering, and I think because of some of this funding that you see coming through the Citizens United case, where people don't know where the money's coming from or who's funding some of these candidates. And so, as a result, you reach deadlock. The folks who are in the middle of the spectrum, and I like to think of myself, you know, I'm a pragmatist. I'm not a politician. I didn't set out to be in Congress, but I got elected. And I've always been focused on the mission. I've always been focused on getting the job done. There are other people who are not focused so much on getting the job done, but they are focused on a particular political philosophy. And whether that philosophy is on one side of the spectrum or the other side of the spectrum, they are more committed to those philosophical goals than they are to getting a job done for the American people. And I'm committed to getting a job done for the American people. So
I think we all understand the dynamics of what's going on. What we don't understand is why some formula can't be found to put that stuff aside and get something done.
Well, I think that's commonly known as the Hastert rule. And the Hastert rule,
yes.
Under former Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert. And that is that the Speaker of the House doesn't want to pass any legislation unless he can pass it with a majority of his majority. And he has some folks who won't go along with it, and so as a result, he's not able to do that. But I think if you took a substantial percentage of the folks on the Republican side of the House and a substantial percentage of the side who are on the Democratic side of the House, you could get bills passed. But under parliamentary procedure, the party with the majority controls the agenda. And so bills that could get passed, I believe, with support of a minority of both parties, but maybe not a supermajority of the party in control of the House could pass. That's probably a little more procedure, a little more detail, than maybe a little more technical than you wanted to hear. But I think that's what's clogging the process up.
Well, we're going to let you get back to work and help unclog the process, hopefully.
Because, well, that's what I've been working on. I guarantee you have.
I'm sure you have. A lot of people are impatient. You know it as well as I do and anybody else who's paying attention to what's going on. But Congressman Bill Enyer, thanks so much for spending some time with us, and we certainly appreciate the moments you could spare.
Thank you, Don. Good talking to you. Good talking to you, General.
Same to you, Congressman. Thank you.
We'll come back and continue our conversation with the General Allardyce. We'll also bring in Jeff Michalki, who is a civilian who works at Scott. He has been listening to all of this. We'll come back and have him join the conversation. We want you to do so as well. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back as we continue our conversation about Scott Air Force Base and what its future is with regard to the sequestration cuts, which are going into effect at Scott and other places around the country on July 8th. Civilian employees will begin their furlough process on July 8th. A couple of other things are happening. The commissary is going to close one day a week. All of this to save money under sequestration. With me in studio is Lieutenant General Robert Allardyce, Vice Commander of Scott's Air Military Command. And joining us by phone now is Jeff Michalki, a civilian employee at Scott. He is also with the Air Mobility Command. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Give me some sense, Jeff, as to what you're going through now and what you're feeling with regard to what lies ahead for you.
Well, we prepared this back months ago when we heard we were going to have 22 days of furlough. My family, we sat down, we decided what we could do and what we couldn't do. And one of the big things was we had to forego any vacation this year. But the other problem is that now we're down to 11 days and everybody's happy with that. We just don't understand why we couldn't start our furlough earlier, where we could take one day off per pay period, which would kind of spread the hurt a little thinner than having two unpaid days per pay period. That's the big thing right now. People are asking that question, why can't we start earlier and get it out of the way?
Let me put the question to the general. Do you know why?
Well, basically the Department of Defense, you know, waited to a certain time to make the decision. They were trying to mitigate, get it down lower, and then we have union rules that we had to follow a very prescriptive approach to this, you know, 30 days notice and go through a deliberate process. By the time all this is done, we're bumped up against the July time.
Jeff, can you give me a sense, and I don't want to get too personal and refuse to answer the question if you like, but can you give me some sense in a very general way of what the economic impact is on your household?
Well, I'm the sole breadwinner for the family, so a 20% pay cut. We have a good savings, so we're gonna do fine with this. But what I'm concerned with is some coworkers. I have a gentleman that makes only half what I make. He's at a lower pay grade, but he's still going to have to maintain a budget, paying his bills. Charter, cable, insurance companies, they really don't care if we're going on a furlough. They still want their payment, and so, you know, it's going to be difficult for him to do it, but that's the heart of it.
What about the stress on yourself and on your family?
Well, now that they've actually served us with our furlough notices, we received them yesterday, it's becoming more realistic, whereas before it was all speculation, so your stress is going up and down. But now that we were served with the notice, it's kind of settling in. We can kind of, okay, here's what we have to do, and here's how we're going to get through it. It's going to look like it's going to happen, so we're prepared for it now than just speculation.
I spoke to Congressman Enyart and also to General Allardyce a few moments ago with regard to morale considerations. How would you assess it?
Morale overall, everybody that I work with, all the civilians I know, we're proud to be federal employees. We're very happy with that. We're just upset that the federal workforce is almost the pawn for the politicians in Washington. And this is no disrespect to Congressman Enyart. I know he just came into office, so he has nothing to do with that. But it's every time something comes up where they need to cut money, they always look at the federal workforce, and they're trying to balance the budget on our backs, and we're trying to do our job and everything. But we had no control over this deficit spending, but yet we're paying the price.
Frustration level must be fairly high because it would appear that very few of us have any opportunity to do anything about that problem.
Yes, it is. It's one of those things where, you know, that we're told what we have to do. We do it. We might be upset about it, but we don't let it affect our work. We do as much as we can. The biggest thing is we're used to work, and sometimes instead of 8 hours a day, you might put in extra 10, 15 minutes just to get something done. Of course, that's unpaid. But now with these furlough notices, we're not even allowed to do anything on the day that we're furloughed. We have to stay away from work. We're not allowed to have any work-related items going on.
We talked earlier about the impact this would have on mission. It's kind of the macro overview, if you will. What about efficiency within your own operation, at your own level at Scott?
Well, we're going to have to maintain our work level, but we're going to have to do it with 8 hours less per week. That doesn't mean we can't stop meeting our suspenses on different projects. If we get a suspense, we have to make sure we get it done, and we're just going to have to, as we call it in the military, is rack and stack. We have to find out what's the highest priority and then go down and make sure we complete what we need and with the time we have.
General, what do you say to someone like Jeff who's preparing to go through this? Summer vacation has been given up, 20% cut in income. There is obviously some stress on family. What do you say to these people?
First off, I say thank you for your service. You know, these civilians are patriots. They work very hard for us. They're a huge force multiplier in our workforce. And so at the headquarters, for example, our employees, at Headquarters Air Mobility Command, we have oversight over the global enterprise running air mobility for the Department of Defense. And we are doing the furlough on Fridays. And on that day, we will suffer a 50% reduction in our workforce on that day. And that's to help us understand and to demonstrate to them that we recognize how much we won't be able to get done on the days that we don't have our civilians. So we try to reflect how much we appreciate with the impact of them. And then, frankly, we try to work with them to mitigate, to provide counseling services, a variety of different services so that, you know, the higher wage employees may be able to mitigate with savings, but some of these younger ones, we have to find different ways to help them. They still have to pay their child care bills. Mm-hmm. There are other bills, as Jeff said. So we try to work for some practical applications there and then, frankly, just provide the shoulder that we can to work. I've actually had general officers walk up to me and say, can I give money, can I give some of my pay to these people to help mitigate the impact? And we talked about ways to do that. You don't want to put any pressures on anybody. But that gives you an idea of how personal it gets with the teammates who are, you know, I'm still getting my salary and my coworker is not. That's tough.
Should your salary be affected in all of this?
That would be a personal that would be a personal decision. And you know, we're patriots, so we're all patriots. And if the country decided that we were going to do something to orient on a crisis, whether it be a military crisis, wartime, we're all going to orient on that and suffer for that and work through it together. If this is a different kind of crisis and that's the way that the senior leaders want to approach it, then again, we're patriots. I think what's important is that we're all going to do that, then we're all going to do that.
Yeah. Well, maybe we ought to start with the IRS and go after its entertainment budget. $50 million.
Sure, we'll let that just sit where it is.
I didn't think you'd respond to that. Jeff, just one other question to you. Of course, the furloughs are serious enough, but you've also got some other things happening. The commissary is closing one day a week. There are going to be some fees for, you know, if you want to take the family swimming at some of the facilities there. This just adds and compounds the problem, does it not?
Yes, with the commissary closing, we'll have to alter our shopping schedule, but that means it's probably going to be more crowded, which could relate to less items on the shelves if they can't restock it. Paying the fees to go swimming or other activities, we're just going to have to look and see, are we able to do it this time, this week, or can we wait a couple days? And we're just going to have to look at it that way.
Well, I know it's a trying time for you, Jeff Michalki. I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you can bear up well under what lies ahead, and I'm guessing you probably can because you've been preparing for it.
Yes, and thank you for letting me join the discussion.
Is there anything you'd like to add before going away?
Again, like I said, everybody out here at Scott, all the civilians, we're still proud to be federal employees. We really wish we didn't have to take this furlough, but we're going to do what we got to do, and we'll get through it, and hopefully it'll be behind us before we know it.
That's Jeff Michalki. He is a civilian employee with the Air Mobility Command over at Scott Air Force Base. Again, Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Right. General, have you learned anything in the conversation that we've had here so far from either the congressman or from Jeff?
I've heard no new information. You know, we have, I would say, an open, transparent process. We communicate. We run the posting sites inside the military system that where we have encouraged civilians to express their concerns and to talk about what's on their mind. And they've been very open, and I've learned a lot in that process, it both up and down the chain, how much, frankly, how smart they are, how informed they are. It doesn't surprise me, but they are incredibly intelligent, and they draw good conclusions. So
one of the things that sometimes happen out of situations like this is that the employer, I'll put the word in quotes that way, finds out that they can actually get along okay without so many people and that maybe overall the workforce can be reduced. Do you have concerns about that?
Well, the way I would frame that is I obviously, if you look at the country and you see that the strategy reviews that are going on and the budget discussions, we're going to seek a level of resourcing within the federal government and within the Department of Defense. And our job is to articulate how much we can deliver from a military air transportation perspective based on the amount of resourcing that we have. And so I kind of look at it as we will do our very best to be as efficient and as effective as possible and say that based on the budget that the nation decides on, this is what we'll produce. And if the nation decides that they want to have a bigger military, we build a bigger, better military. If they want a smaller military, we'll build a smaller military. But we have to be very careful here is, you know, years ago I had the privilege to serve in Iraq. My job was to rebuild the Iraqi Air Force. We started with nothing. And it was more an appreciation for what we have in this nation in terms of intellectual capital, training systems, all. It takes a lot to build an Air Force and to be able to hold a target at risk anywhere in the world. And to be able to, for example, last year we had I believe it was a New Zealander who was sick in Antarctica in the middle of their winter. They asked if we could get them transported off of Antarctica. And I would kind of joke that a few years ago we just said take two aspirin and call us, you know, in the spring. But we called in one day. We prepared an aeromedical evacuation crew in Hawaii. We had a C-17 took off out of Washington State. We flew down, picked up the aeromedical evacuation team, and went and landed in Antarctica in the middle of their winter at night without lights. We used night vision goggles to do this. An incredible aviation feat. Picked up the patient, got them back to medical care, saved their life. If you want to be able to do that kind of a thing or respond to Libya or respond to whatever, you have to have a trained force. we'll do what the best we can with the resources the nation gives us.
Yeah. I want to talk more about the mission, because a lot of people don't really understand what goes on over and around and through Scott Air Force Base. But before we take our next break, didn't get a chance to talk much with the congressman about BRAC and the potential for closing some military bases. This, I think, is probably above your pay grade, if you don't mind saying that, as to what's going to happen.
I'm fine with that comment.
Yeah. But what do you think? Do you think Scott is in any way in any kind of jeopardy as they continue to look to save money to close part of it, at least?
First, to be really clear and to scope it, you know, it's not my job to say whether or not
sure.
Scott would be there. My observation is this. Across the Air Force, we're oversubscribed in infrastructure across the Air Force. We have too much infrastructure for the airplanes we have. It would be our broad look, and we would leave that to our senior leaders to say how much. But we've brought down a lot of airplanes over the past decade or two, and we haven't reduced infrastructure. That's the broad statement. Scott Air Force Base, though, is an absolute jewel in our national defense capability. The communication structure that we have there, our capability to command and control the global transportation enterprise. Transcom does transportation. We do global air enterprise right there from Scott Air Force Base. We'll talk about some of the neat stories later on today. But that capability, combined with all the other capabilities that you have at Scott, make it a real treasure. And I think you heard the congressman's comments on his thoughts on the future.
Yeah, we have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back and continue the conversation about the mission and about your future as well. We'll continue that conversation, as I say, with Lieutenant General Robert Allardyce, Vice Commander of Scott's Air Mobility Command. We had Congressman Bill Enyart with us earlier in the program, and he, of course, his district represents Scott. And Jeff Michalki was also with us, a civilian employee at Scott. We want your questions as well. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation with General Allardyce from the Air Mobility Command at Scott Air Force Base. You know, General, as I mentioned a moment ago, a lot of people really don't have a sense for what the full mission is over there. I've been over there, and I've been in the big room, whatever they call it, where you can see everything that's in the air at any given time. Give us kind of an overview of the various things that you folks are doing.
Well, thanks, Don, for that. And let me start off this segment by just saying what a great place to be and a neat job. Yeah. The room that you were in is called the Tanker Airlift Control Center. That's the nerve center for our global air mobility operations, which it's truly a global operation. For example, today we have 717 missions worldwide that are being controlled out of that facility. So I told a story earlier about going down into the what we call down on the ice on the Antarctica in the middle of the winter. That was controlled right there at Scott Air Force Base. When the Libya operation started going down, the tanker air refueling missions where we refuel fighters, that was being controlled out of the Tanker Airlift Control Center. Civilian flights that were going to Japan during the tsunami, those were being controlled out of that place. So at Scott Air Force Base, my headquarters, we are in charge of making sure that we have a global system that can either surge to a wartime or humanitarian relief, prepare for that, and then when a crisis does occur, make sure that we have a global enterprise set up and in place so that then we can respond and then control the airplanes that respond. That's it at AMC. There's also the Guard 126 wing. We have a reserve wing. Those are both forces that generate and go do the mission. And then, of course, U.S. Transportation Command, and that's our parent command, and they're the ones that control transportation for all of the Department of Defense. So that's sea, big ships that float around out there, right. And then the Army Service Distribution Command. All that is done right there at Scott Air Force Base. The amount of information that flows through that base every single day and then goes out supporting all the different commands in the U.S. military and non-military organizations we support sometimes. It's really phenomenal.
You know, it's been a few years since I was there, but I was surprised to see that there were a number of television monitors there in which folks were watching CNN.
Sure.
And I said, what are you doing that for? And they said, sometimes CNN gets the word, you know, about an impending crisis faster than we get it through normal channels.
Sure. So 2 years ago in 2010 when the tsunami happened in Japan. This is a typical what happens in the world. I got a call at 2:30 in the morning from the controller at the Tanker Airlift Control Center. He says, sir, turn on the TV. I turned on the TV. I literally saw the tsunami coming across the shore. I asked him to start looking at the number of airplanes we had. At 5 o'clock in the morning, I called the commander of the TACC and said, how many airplanes do we have on alert? Where are they in the world? And how long will it take to bring them to bear? Within 24 hours, we were already flowing stuff, whatever the stuff is, in that particular operation. That's why those monitors are on. And often in the world, we joke that when something will be going on, you'll see a news reporter talking or whatever. In the backdrop, you'll see a T-tail, an airplane with a tail that has the military tail flash. Mm-hmm. That will be one of our airplanes that will be doing a mission.
It's a fascinating place. Let's go to the phones, General Allardyce. We'll begin with Angela calling from St. Louis. Angela, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just also, you know, wanted to mention, I don't know if people really realize, I do happen to work also for the federal government, but not over at Scott Air Force Base. But I happen to be on the committee in charge of the CFC, which is the Combined Federal Campaign. And I tell you, the employees over at Scott, you know, just it, the CFC is a federal program where all federal employees are asked to donate to a whatever charity they so want to. But just over at Scott Air Force Base alone, you know, those employees donate, you know, roughly around $1 million out of their own paycheck to go to local charities. And I would not be surprised if some of them are going to end up canceling their donations because their paycheck's going to be impacted, you know, and that's just going to have another ripple effect on, say, the United Way or the Red Cross or things of that nature.
Angela, thanks for the call. You want to respond to
Angela, you very likely might be correct. I mean, some of the younger folks, frankly, who want to give may not be able to. One of the neat things about living in America is that somehow somebody seems to be able to make it up, and we certainly hope that would happen in this case.
Angela, thanks for the call. I have an email here from Tracy says asking, do contract employees working at Scott take furlough days as well? My understanding from a current contractor at Scott is they do not, and if that is the case, how does it affect civilian employees' morale to see the contractors continuing to work and get paid?
That I will tell you the two answers to this. Number one, we don't control how the contractor, whatever the vendor is, how they pay their employees. And so it is possible that in a place where we have contractors working, they will continue to be employed by their employer while the civilian employee is furloughed. Now, with that said, the sequester, all we've talked about so far today is the impact on the civilian employees. But, for example, at Headquarters Air Mobility Command, we have looked at every single contract we have. We will continue to look at every single contract. The downward pressures on our budget are very significant. And so without, you know, we have to follow contract guidelines, all that, but there are clearly some services that we've curtailed. There's some that we have canceled, and frankly, we'll probably cancel others. And so in those cases, those contracts go away, or if we've canceled them, completely.
I have another question here via email. History has a way of repeating itself. As was the case with other wars, the U.S. military scales back after it was built up. As we wind down operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, isn't it reasonable to expect that there won't be as many resources for the military, including those at Scott Air Force Base? Conversely, I suppose you could also say there would be more resources available if we're spending less in trouble spots.
Yeah, the thing about – and you're absolutely right. If you look at the historical trends, we would expect to see some contraction. Remember, we have been at a operational surge, significant level of effort since 9/11. In fact, our very first missions on the 7th of October 2001, when we first night we went into Afghanistan, we had airplanes that we were command and controlling right here at Scott Air Force Base that were C-17s delivering humanitarian supplies to the Afghan people on night one of the operations. And we've been at an incredible operational surge since then with some slack, but not a lot of slack. As you come down out of that, the military as a whole, you would expect in some cases to see some retraction. The thing that I would just want our national leaders to be, and I'm sure they're being very careful and considerate of, it takes a long time to build an Air Force. It takes, just take an aircraft mechanic, for example, about 7 years to make a high-level aircraft mechanic in our Air Force, about 7 years, just a mechanic. If we let that mechanic go, it takes at least 7 years to get that mechanic mm-hmm. back. And so these are things that if we want to become a more mobile force or any of those things, the air mobility forces, the people that are flying the refuelers, the air transportation, and the air medical evacuation, that's the hospital ships that we fly, those are capabilities that it's a crown jewel. And if you look around the world, no other nation has that capability. Mm-hmm. It's a treasure that we just ought to be very careful how we tinker with it.
Sure. Let's take another call. We'll bring in Jerry calling from O'Fallon, Missouri. Jerry, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Gentlemen, I sympathize with your situation, but I guess we have, you know, a lot of people that want less government, and I guess I say just, you know, give them less government, and I guess the ability for some people to empathize with anyone else's pain just doesn't occur, and until it affects them, which unfortunately a lot of these things are going to be directly and indirectly affecting our economy for a long time. But I mean, I was inundated with messages and Facebook postings the day after the sequester went into effect with people saying, oh, see, it's not so bad and everything is still running. And as you're explaining in your own part of the situation, there are effects, there are immediate effects, and I think the long-term effects are going to be felt for a while. And it's unfortunate, but I guess it's just a matter of what the political priorities are. So best of luck.
Jerry, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks, Jerry. And you know, as a patriot myself, I would say that you said the political realities, and I would hope that it's what the citizens want. And so if the citizens of our nation choose to have a smaller federal government, then I would offer that that's what we got to do. And the size of the military that the citizens of our country want, we need to respect that, and we will do with what we can with the military that the citizens pay for.
Everybody, or not everybody, but a lot of folks want less government until their ox has been gored or a tornado has come through or a tsunami has hit or whatever. Then they pretty much want the government to step in and take care of them. That's my observation. I'm not expecting you to comment on that. But I am interested in how decisions are made with regard to moving into an area for humanitarian assistance. You folks were involved with following Hurricane Sandy. You've mentioned the tsunami in Japan, and there are other parts of the world. How are these decisions made? How quickly can they be made, and who makes them?
There are a variety of decisions that can be made, and so depending on the crisis. For example, at Scott Air Force Base, we also have headquarters 18th Air Force. They're the operational headquarters who the Tanker Airlift Control Center works for. They are constantly looking around the world, the globe, to see what kind of crises might be emerging. And they're planning. You know, yesterday I took an intelligence update. We'll obviously get into specifics, but they discuss what different things are going on. As we take about a six-month outlook, what efforts might they want to focus on to be prepared? If a hurricane starts to develop off the west coast of Africa, that's about a one-week timeline. They begin to look at it, and in fact, even this time of year, they'll be planning and considering and starting to develop the courses of action for a crisis. As that crisis comes closer, whether it be a man-made crisis or a natural crisis, then the decision to employ military force is made by the president, and then that cascades on down. And the Secretary of Defense has some authorities, too, for humanitarian. But once that decision is made and the United States Transcom commander, tells us to start moving forces, our job is to be able to move forces that fast. And so that preparation time and the decision for the preparation, that's setting the enterprise for success. And then the decision is based on the political leadership to employ forces, to support an operation. When they say to do it, we should have already done all the analysis. Can we get an airplane in there? Will they need medical support? If they do we have the medical crews lined up to provide that level of support? That will all take place.
But if another country is involved, do you have to wait? Do we as a country have to wait? Does the president have to wait until someone from that country contacts him or through the State Department or whatever, saying we could really use a hand here?
the answer to that is really it depends. And so our, you know, we look at it as we have to have the authority, the legal authority to employ force. The resource line needs to be there. There are some in extremist situations, but we have to have that authority. That authority comes from our civilian leadership. And so we wait for that green light, so to speak.
But if you're sending one of those big planes down to the Antarctic for one person, who decides that that one person is worth the expense?
That authority came – I'd have to do some research, but that we did have the authority to do that. And that was a request made from one nation to our nation to support them. And we had a – we actually support the National Science Foundation in that operation. And in that relationship, those authorities were arranged.
Do we ever say no?
I don't know of a time where we've said no to somebody whose life is threatened. You know, and if I can bridge just for a minute, one of the neatest missions we have is the aeromedical evacuation mission. Every day I'd say even unfortunately are moving people who have been wounded in combat or in a humanitarian crisis. You know, we may be moving somebody. Any air crew member who operates one of these airplanes, and it can be any of our airplanes with a medical crew on board, it's a life-changing experience. We had a young lady, one of our very own stationed at Charleston Air Force Base, who was wounded on Friday. She hit by an improvised explosive device. She's a medical technician, but she was on in a convoy, and it blew up, and she got wounded. She was immediately provided first aid, and 3 days later, she's at Walter Reed in Washington, D.C. That system is what brought her home. That system is a life-changing event. And
a life-saving event.
And a life-saving event. It's a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, not everybody always makes it, but sure. But it's a neat part of our mission.
We have time, I think, for one more call. That'll be Tyler calling from St. Louis. Tyler, it'll have to be quick.
Good morning. I enlisted in the Army after 9/11, and I saw lots of what were MOSs, military occupation specialties, that were filled by DOD civilians that the Army and the Air Force had actually trained soldiers and airmen to do. And I was wondering if you had any comment about those jobs going back to the airmen and soldiers to do rather than paying DOD civilians to do them.
Yeah, I'm not aware exactly. Well, my broad thing I would tell you is that we train people to do the job. If we have a military necessity, it has to be a person in uniform in order to accomplish it, then I would leave it there. But if a civilian can accomplish it, and it doesn't require a uniformed person for all the reasons, then we ought to leave it with the military civilians.
The civilians are more expensive, though, I would assume. Contracted civilians?
I don't believe that's true. We can get some statistics, but to put an airman out there is more expensive than to put a civilian employee. Yes, sir.
Really? In the time we have left, there are some indications that, like so much of the infrastructure in this country, some of it is maybe wearing down a little bit of Scott. Is that the case? I note here that newer air tanker aircraft can't operate there because the facilities can't accommodate them.
I believe that comment is in reference to the KC-46 bed down decision. And what that really gets into is the analysis for the first couple of bases for the KC-46, we looked across the Air Force Enterprise to see who already had hangars available that could house that particular weapon system. And then that was a portion of the analysis for what the first couple of bases would be. And that's specifically the hangars that are at Scott are not sufficient to provide for that mission.
But it's not becoming a rundown facility in any sense of
the No, that not about the quality of the hangar. That had to do with matching it for that particular airplane.
Okay, we've got a minute left. You're leaving all of this in the not too distant future and retiring. You're gonna miss this life?
Oh yeah. Susan and I, my wife, have. You got me off guard. 33 years, 3 daughters, all in the Air Force.
Wow.
And what a great life. I wouldn't do anything different.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you so much for your service. You've got a chest full of ribbons there that I couldn't even begin to describe to our audience, but let me just say it's about the size of a dinner plate. Thank you so much.
Thanks, General Don. Howard. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Right. And again, thank you for your service and all of those with whom you're associated.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with actress and director Marsha Mason about her career, her St. Louis ties, and her appearances this weekend for Insight Theater Company. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Before I say goodbye, I'd like to also thank Illinois 12th District Congressman Bill Enyart for being with us earlier in the program, and also Jeff Michalki, a civilian employee at Scott with the Air Mobility Command. We thank them for their help in today's program. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.